calling for open line.
But a lot of people don't proper grounding either with their stuff. They daisy chain it. They don't have a common ground on there. And I had this one guy, he said, well, I've been in amateur radio for 50 years. You got to have RF all over your house. I said, come on down. Key up. I have security cameras, stereo system, everything, and there's no RF in this house generating. And I have meters right by my stuff there, and nothing is moving.
Wonderful.
Let me tell you a story about that box outside when I first started off. If you got a minute?
Sure.
All right, my friend Clark, I'm not giving him this call sign because he likes to be kind of, you know, in the shadows. So we got it all working, and you know, AM is consistent duty. So I tuned it around. I got on the sideband, and I got good reports from it. So I said, let me go to AM on there. On 160, so I'm chattering away, you know, consistent duty, things warm up. Antenna box there, and I put my, there's that 3-inch pipe there with 50 winds, a 12-inch, and then 50 winds on the center. And I can feel the tape a little bit warm, the electrical tape, I wrapped it with. So I call my friend, he says, well, it's getting stuck in there, in that 12 gauge. Which I go, I mean, the 12 gauge, he says, you know, he told me, up the wire. I says, well, I got a 10-gauge variable grounding wire. He goes, put that in there. I wrapped that up there. Never got warm. So I got this because I do stand up there. And I tell people that I'm tuning up an 80-meter, a 40-meter antenna on 80 meters. I said, well, you better feel your antenna tuner because it's going to get warm. I said, why? Because all the energy is stuck in your tuner. It's not getting out properly. And basically, my friend Clark said the same thing. So I had this. You know, my stand-up comedy. I said, so you're telling me it's constipated?
Okay. I mean, there are antennas that are infamous for having the most lossy balance in the world. It's broadly tuned because it really just acts as a dummy load. It just attenuates your return signal and your equipment miscalculates the VISWA.
Exactly, and I get a 1.1 or 0 SWRs on everything I tune up there. And I went out there and put my hand on that coil. It hasn't warmed up yet. And you know AMers. We're known for our old buzzer transmissions, WNWR.
Yes, indeed.
A thought?
Certainly.
The thing that seems to be trending in my mind as I put the pieces of this whole stuff together as still a newbie is that beyond the tuner is the antenna. And if you put the tuner in the middle of the transmission or the start of the transmission line and then imagine there's 50 or 100 feet of transmission beyond the tuner, you're missing the point. Because once you put the tuner wherever you put it, whatever exists beyond it is part of the antenna, and the tuner is going to work with that. And that may be good, and it may be bad, because weird things happen from there. Common wall current, weird transmission patterns, whatever. And that doesn't mean anything is right or wrong. It just means, I think that's, you have to start with perceiving that as the sentence. What's beyond the tuner is the antenna, and what's before the tuner is the transmission line. And the circumstances that happen from there are quite variable, but they start with that premise, I think. I could be completely wrong, for your consideration.
Yeah, I would tend to disagree. The portion between the feed line of the antenna and the transmission line going into the antenna tuner is still really a transmission line. It's I mean, some of it is going back and forth common mode and radiating as an antenna. A lot of it is going back and forth and acting as a absorber of energy. So it's almost like putting it through a dummy load and such, an attenuation device. So it works somewhat differently. Some of it is radiating, but a lot of it is just reflecting back and forth and ending up as thermal losses. So it's always a good thing, if you can, to put the antenna tuner at the antenna feed point rather than farther back where the standing waves are going to bounce back your energy, you know, a number of times and entail some losses in the transmission line.
Exactly. I know a lot of guys that have their tuners at the what we call the base of your feed line from your line there, your bounce line, straight down to the ground. That's where the and then the coax comes back to the house. Basically, AM radio stations do the same thing. I actually have one being built. It's all remote there. It's going to go on the bottom of the feed line, and then the LMR 400 coax is going to come to the house. And this one guy, he goes, you're going to have all RF in your house. I go, how do you mean? All the RF is still outside, 125 feet, the tuner's away from there. Now, I'm only tuning up the feed line up to the antenna, and that's it. I'm not coming back to the house, and he couldn't understand that.
I don't know. You got a bunch of friends who don't understand things about it.
Understanding that what's beyond that tuner is the antenna, intended or not.
Yeah, I mean, there would be no reason to spend the extra expense of weatherizing the antenna tuner if that wasn't the case. You get much less loss. I mean, you could switch and set to open line because open line has significantly far less attenuation problems to bouncing back and forth. But, you know, ultimately, if you have a nice weatherproof antenna tuner that you could remotely control and you put it right at the feed point, that's probably your best bang for your buck.
Oh, no, this is going to be all sealed there. I know guys that put, and there's one of them in Long Island, KT2RT there, out there in Long Island. He built a nice, like a little shed there. I have a friend of mine in Long Island. He's got his Johnson Viking kilowatt matchbox and Tupperware thing there, container, and goes out there and has it all tuned. And then again, you got guys that tune their, and they stick on one band and that's only. And they cut that antenna exactly to that band, and that's it. And I try to explain to people, an antenna tuner is basically something to lie to your radio. All your radio wants is 50 ohms. It doesn't matter how you do it.
Yeah, but I mean, some people take it a few steps extra, and they say that it's just a confidence item, that it doesn't accomplish anything. It accomplishes things. It lets you get your transmitter working without it squealing like a stuck pig.
I have an LP 100 and a 500, SWR meter. And it has modes that show me if I'm, and when I tune up, I don't tune it up for the SWRs. I put it in the mode that is showing me at 50 ohms there. But, like I said, everything's balanced line. There's nothing off on there. And I've had no problems in all the years since in 2007 that I had this set up there. So, but a lot of guys don't understand that, you know, running properly, proper wire, balancing. No, everybody keeps telling me, you need a balun on there, or a balun, or whatever. So, why? I said, what does a balun do? Oh, it takes it from unbalanced to balanced. So if I'm cutting a completely balanced antenna, why do I need that on my set?
Yeah, yes, indeed.
I have a good conversational answer.
Okay.
So you may have a balanced antenna, but at some point, because at some point in history, people decided, from what I understand, because of World War II, extra coax to have 50 ohm outputs unbalanced out of transceivers, and that's just how they all come. The match to balance and unbalance transceiver end starts with that. I'm no expert in this, but that's the way I understand it.
Look at Blue Ridge Amateur Radio, Corey. He's a guy who learned a lot of machinists and tooling and making his own stuff. I've been waiting, it's going on over 2 years for this tuner. It's probably, and I got the ST5-1500 symmetric Pi network tuner, and this thing is the cat's meow. And a lot of people wait, and everybody I talk to says it's probably one of the best tuners, and he is actually billing me the one that's going to go outside, that's going to be all remote, and all in a sealed container.
Sounds like a beauty.
All servos, what you use in a Comet, what the heck is, I'll think of it, senior moment. A vacuum variable capacitor on there.
Ah, nothing but the best. Gee, it must be expensive.
I don't know what he's going for. I've been on that list for a while there, so unfortunately, Corey's a nice guy. When you got on the list first there, and the prices are going up because of material and stuff like that, and labor, but he's pretty fair and honest. So I'm not going to say the price there for my $1,500 when I first got on the list there. And one guy says it's worth the wait, but he's doing this all by himself. He learned machinists. He learned amateur radio. He learned how to paint and everything, because you can get it any color you want there. So, and he's even got a paint chart on his, I think he does. I haven't looked on it in a while. So it's worth the wait there. How many guys are actually doing this? The next close thing there is the Timtron there. He says the only other tuner that comes close to this that is a modern tuner would be the PALSTARS. That's the only close thing. And I got an AT4K, which I would have gone with the 2K, but they stopped the 2K in balanced tuners, and that's all I like. And I use that for 160 because I can do a Timtron mod on the matchbox and put a 160 coil set up with it. But the AT4K has been working on 160 there, so, you know. But like I said, a lot of people seem to turn around and run and push the button on buying stuff instead of looking for stuff or building.
Well, it's easier to hand over your credit card than it is to build stuff, unfortunately. But I have two PALSTAR antenna tuners here in the shack. You have an LP500 as well?
No, they had a problem with the Bowen on there. And they, the guys have found out on it, and even Paul knew about it. And I know they came out and guys built the Mongo Bowen, which worked much better, and there wasn't having problems with it. But, I'm like, why do I need a 5K? I'm not running that kind of power. And the 4K works fine. I also have the K70YY. I don't know if anybody, Bruce Franklin passed away just earlier this year. And he builds the D-class AM transmitter in 160 and 80 and 80 and 40 MOSFET there. And I've had it for years. And a lot of guys keep blowing FETs and everything, tripping off in high SWRs. It is sensitive. But a lot of guys have been using high Q antennas tuners, and that keeps snapping their units out there. And I tried to explain in my Elmer Clark W1WR, that's me, and just announcing my call signs. And he said that there's three things in the K70YY to keep that thing from popping out, because it shows high SWRs and everything. And that's the thing that I try to get Bruce to say, you know, shut off or fault there, something's wrong. And he says, with this unit, it plays a big part. Your modulation peaks, your SWRs, and your power. And it's kind of like a fire triangle that we have in the fire department. Heat, fuel, and oxygen. If any one of those triangles are out of a fire triangle, you don't have a fire. It's the same thing with this K70YY. If your modulation's hitting too hard, your SWRs or your power, it keeps tripping the unit off.
Okay, very good, Rob. Thank you so much. I enjoyed our conversation. I hope you'll keep coming back for more of these. But it's 10:20, and it's time for Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report. But thank you very much, Rob. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight.
Yeah, look up the Blue Ridge Amateur Radio on that WNW. Thank you for running the net 73s, everybody. Good luck in the rain tomorrow.
Paul?
Yeah, very good. What rain? Every time I look at the radar, that thing is always wrong lately, the last couple of years. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, Roy, good net so far. And, we'll cover a couple of space topics. And I know Jim had a question, but let me just go over this one thing first. It's a Capstone 2 mission that they want to launch next year. Capstone 2, you can tell that was a Capstone 1. Capstone 1 was launched by Rocket Lab about 4 years ago on one of his small electron rockets to the moon. And the purpose of the mission was to see if this orbital plan that NASA had for the SLS crew land on the moon would be a good orbit. And they plan on having a gateway space station up there. And the idea was to dock with the gateway space station. And, you know, spend some time there. And then eventually, you know, when they got their act together, they could fly down to the surface of the moon. But to do that, they needed to go into this high elliptical orbit. And I mean very high elliptical orbit. Around the moon, 40,000 miles away from the moon, and then come back close to around 1,000 miles near the moon, and over would take roughly 11 days, you know, for a trip to make one complete orbit. But they wanted to know if this was a practical orbit where they could eventually do this. So they sent Capstone out there, this small, well, I think it was around 400-pound satellite that Rocket Lab sent out there and put it into that exact orbit, you know, 40,000 miles high, 1,000 miles low, perigee and apogee. And it turns out quite very little fuel is used to sustain that orbit. And so what happened now was they need to fine-tune that, and they needed to do it showing as if there were three spacecraft up at the same time. To do that, they're going to send two of these Capstone spacecraft instead of one. Next year, and this way they'll be able to confirm that multiple spacecraft would be able to find each other, locate each other, either with RF or with laser communications. They wanted to see how the accuracy is going to be, so they're planning this Capstone 2 mission, which I'm looking forward to seeing them do that. They don't have a launch vehicle. Yeah, which is weird. I mean, I guess I'm going to guess that Rocket Lab will probably do it because they did the first one. And, you know, maybe they'll even use their new neutron rocket that they're developing, a medium lift vehicle. You know, it's quite large. I mean, it's big for a medium lift vehicle, but that's called a neutron rocket. But, you know, they might even go with SpaceX or something. We'll see. They haven't defined the launch vehicle yet. They do want to send it up in 27. You know, and now that makes me wonder, you know, Isaacman, the NASA administrator now, says that there is not going to be any more space station. Okay? So What do you need this capstone mission for? It looks like they're planning to eventually use that same orbit. Instead of using a space station, they plan on using a SpaceX Starship as one vehicle instead of a space station to have this ridiculously high orbit. And then when time comes due, now here's Starship in this big long orbit in the not too distant future, here comes the SLS Space Launch System with the crew of four that they plan on docking with now with Starship. And they plan on staying like that as if Starship is a space station. So they haven't talked much about it. I mean, they're making it look like this whole thing is done. I think Starship is going to just take the spacecraft from Earth orbit, bring it immediately to low moon orbit, and do away with this other system. But I think that they know that that's not going to be practical in the long run. So I think there's going to be a lot of changes made, and I'm not really looking forward to a very early lunar landing, that's for sure. Things seem like they're very much up in the air. We'll find out more about it as time goes on, but capstone mission's a go. I mean, it's been financed, and they're going to look into it. Any comments? WS2N. Okay. And I don't know if you wanted to ask a question. You had a space question before it gets later. Any later, back to you.
I do have a question regarding that big Starship thing that just landed in the ocean. You game?
Oh, okay. You want to talk about Starship? Starship number 13.
I believe that's the one.
Okay, I know we covered it last week, but I put an update on it. But what's your question regarding it before I start going on and on?
Okay, KD2BHD. I've never owned a spacecraft. Never operated one. Never flown one. Never maintained one. Never built one. But I've operated a fair amount of equipment on the beach, surf fishing and camping and outdoor type stuff, and nothing I've ever seen or heard of can take being doused in ocean water and not rapidly destroyed, both mechanically by the corrosion of the salt water and electrically far faster and far more catastrophically. And so now we have this Starship thing, huge and complicated, I assume. I don't know anything about it, really. And they're landing it in the water so gracefully. But when I see a machine landing in the salt water of the ocean, that machine is no longer useful for anything that requires any sort of reliability. So what's going on there? Back to you. Thank you for taking the question.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I know that's a problem that a lot of the missions in the past have dealt with. But if you look at the Dragon spacecraft that comes back, the cargo vehicle, that's been landing in the Atlantic Ocean for years. Now they have them landing in the Pacific Ocean. Also, the crew vehicles that are coming back with four people on it at a time, again, landing in, well, at one time the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico, but now they've changed to the Pacific Ocean as well. And for other reasons, it's another long story. But they've gone from the East Coast to the West Coast. But those things are all reusable. I mean, they've been reusing the cargo and crew vehicles for many, many years now. So, you know, they've managed to get around it. You know, it lands in the water. SpaceX has their own boat. They come along, they pick it out of the water. And then, you know, it's dry docked, and they work on it, they clean it up, and they launch again. So, yeah, back to you, Jim, for any comments in that regard, and then we'll talk about Starship.
So it was my impression that they landed on barges in the water for the reusable components, and the disposable components landed in the water. Maybe I got that wrong. I certainly don't follow it as closely as you do. But when I saw that this past 13 landing in the water, that's no longer a viable machine for, you know, picking corn, let alone flying to space. That's been my experience. That's tough. Now, sure, you know, a spacecraft is different than my Jeep. It's been designed far more thoroughly, far more expensively to deal with circumstances. But if my Jeep stops working, it just stops on the beach and I take a beer out of the cooler. When my Jeep stops working, other stuff happens. So when I saw that thing lay down in the water, I'm like, nah, something ain't adding up here. Something not adding up. Something stinks.
Yeah, by the way, that wasn't the plan for them to actually have that thing floating there. That's a bonus for the company. But yeah, just to finish up with the way that, you know, I'm at the spacecraft itself and the cargo vehicle itself that goes up and either docks with the International Space Station or some of the cargo, some of the crew vehicles, they've actually had independent flights where they did not dock with the space station. For instance, Inspiration 4, they call it, some years ago. That had nothing to do with going to the space station. By the way, Jared Isaacman was the commander on that, as well as a second mission too that he went on. That he was the first private individual, you know, nothing to do with NASA, to do a spacewalk. Him and another woman. But then when they came back, it lands in the water, Gulf of Mexico, or the Atlantic or the Pacific. But that's just the vehicle. The big ones that you're talking about, the boosters, the first stage is 170-foot. It's 170-foot first stage with the 9 Merlin engines on it. You know, that monster. Yeah, that pushes the crew vehicle and the Dragon cargo vehicles into orbit. You know. And it's like, what is it, 1/8 of the whole rocket is you know, used by the crew. The rest of it, you know, it's all fuel and rocket engines. Well, that first stage comes back down and lands on the drone ships. They have three drone ships that they could land on. And it lands vertically, and they pull it back, and it's all reused. Never lands in the water. Or sometimes quite a few times now, they'll bring the first stage back to land, which they've been doing in Florida for many years now, and as well as California. They bring the first stage back to land as well, too. So that's the story on that. The Starship itself, that was not planned to actually do what it did, but they lucked out because they were able to get fantastic pictures of the heat shield and with the bad drones out there flying. By the way, that ocean is the Indian Ocean that you see that floating around in. And never planned, that vehicle was never planned to be reused. They're just taking all the technical information off of it as they can. So the engines, everything, I'm sure it's going to be scrapped. If they bring it back, by the way, I still haven't gotten that. Many hours later, after watching it float around, I heard it was still floating around. And one guy made a comment that they won't be able to bring it back to shore because there's still a lot of fuel in it. They plan on, destroying it and let it sink. Well, not being NASA, I guess that information is not going to be released anytime soon. I might have missed it. But say it is towed back to land, and they put it on a big barge and float this. I guess 270 feet long. Let me think. This is Starship. Starship, I think, is around 100. I want to say 170 feet long, I believe. So anyway, this massive thing looked like a tank floating around. I right away, looking at the close-up pictures, all these white streaks all over it, And then searched on the internet. Looks like the white streaks, are coming from the material in between each tile. There's, I forget, over 10,000-15,000 tiles on this thing that they use for heat. You thought after space shuttle with all the problems with the tiles, you wouldn't be hearing about tiles anymore. But with Starship, that's what they have. They have their own versions of it. Most of them are hexagon-looking tiles. You can see that when you look close. But in between all the cracks, you see these white lines, these streaks. So this is supposed to be a reusable vehicle. Not that one, but the ones in the future. They plan on going into orbit, coming back to Boca Chica, Texas, where it took off from. And then coming out of the sky and catching it with these big arms, and then refueling it, putting it back on top of another booster, and relaunching it over and over again. This is supposed to be a reusable vehicle. I don't think they're going to reuse it if they're getting these streaks. Those streaks are caused from the water. They're being caused from the 2,000 plus degrees, as they're coming through the atmosphere. That's usually the temperatures that they get coming back from 17,500 miles an hour. This thing came back from 16,000 miles an hour. You forget, there's not much of a difference. I think it goes up squared every time you double the speed or something. The amount of heat, for instance, when they come back from the moon, tiles have to withstand heat up to 5,000 degrees, and they're coming back at 25,000 miles an hour. So they're going to have to work on this, I think, before it becomes a true reusable vehicle. Just to go to the moon, they want to put one big floating tank in orbit and have a dozen starships just like that go up and refuel it. And then at some point take all that fuel from that one tanker and again pour that fuel now into a brand new starship that they send up, and that'll be the starship that goes to the moon, orbits the moon, lands on the moon, and brings the crew back. I'm hoping they move along with the program, but I hope they don't rush where they get somebody injured. Back to you.
I'm just merely addressing the concept of that the reports on this thing, they showed this really neat video of the thing landing in the ocean, and we're going to send it back up again. You can't do that with a cigarette lighter or a calculator. You dump an electronic instrument into the ocean, it's shot. It's kaput. It's done. It's over. It's nothing you can do to fix it. It's over. For only modest reliability expectations. If you look over 100% reliability, like I think we're looking for with the space program, and the fact that it wasn't even addressed in the press thing. Yeah, we landed this thing in the water. Oh, that's a good day. Happy day. See you later. Seems so ridiculous to me.
Why are you having me laughing? If that's what you heard, whoever that person was, does not know what he's talking about. I mean, there's no way that thing's going to be reused. It was never planned to be reused. Some of the boosters, I think they caught three of them so far. The boosters have come back, and out of the three, only one was reused so far. But they don't land in the water. Starship itself, the one that's floating around the water, not planned on ever touching the water. All the missions that they have planned, you know, they plan on coming out of orbit, flying back to either Boca Chica, Texas, where it took off from, or to Florida. They're building a launch facility there, and I guess you would call it a catch system as well. So, yeah, both the booster and Starship, the one that's floating around the water, all planning on coming back to land, being caught, and then restacked and reused. That's the plan. Nothing to do with the water. The only reason this is headed to the water, the ones before it were planned to go to the Indian Ocean. This is number 13. They keep launching one after the other, you know, and they keep changing the. They call it version 1, version 2. They're up to version 3. And every time they change that, there's more problems. And so they got their hands full. But this one overall worked 100%, 99%. Especially the Starship that wound up in the Indian Ocean did everything it had to do. It was planned suborbital flight. None of them were planned on ever going to orbit. Musk did say number 14, next one, is planned on going to orbit for the first time. We'll see how that goes. Back to you, Jim. WS2S.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. Please continue, and appreciate your attention to that matter.
Yeah, I know. Sometimes the news people get carried away. Years ago, they had something called the Constellation program. That was going to be the moon landing system. I guess this is probably, was it George Bush 2 or 1? I guess 2. That was his plan. They were going to send, you know, they were going to send a crew on a separate rocket, and they were going to dock with this other lander. This lander was about two times the size of the LEM that from years ago. And anyway, this whole project Constellation was eventually canceled. After that was canceled, they needed to eventually keep part of the Constellation program. Part of it was the Orion spacecraft, this thing that goes on the Space Launch System. So they needed to test it back in 2012, the first time they launched the uncrewed version of the Space Launch System, and they put it on a Delta rocket. Yeah, they put it on this Delta heavy rocket. It's three Delta rockets bolted together. and they put the Orion spacecraft on top just to test it. They wanted to put it around 4,000 miles out into space, just straight up, and then bring it straight down, and they just really wanted to test the heat shield, among other things. And so they had this big launch. It was, all the news people got down there, and I was listening to the news. In fact, they still have it on tape. The guy said, you know, after it launched, see, this rocket that's going to be sending people to the moon. Oh, the Delta IV had nothing to do with sending people to the moon. It was just testing this one vehicle out. The one that was going to the moon is the Space Launch System. At the time, wasn't even built yet, and which eventually has been launched two times, once with the Orion spacecraft that was unmanned that went around the moon and came back, and then of course with the crew of four that they just went up this last time months ago. But yeah, they get it wrong. Oh, that's the rocket that's going to go to the moon. And nobody corrects them. You know, it's like they make these statements. You know, isn't somebody like in the control room that, you know, talks through the headpiece and says, by the way, that's not right. WSUN, any further comments, Jim or anybody else?
That's because I'm not there. Carry on.
Yeah. Okay, very good. I got time. NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman has plans on sending an uncrewed vehicle to Mars, but he wants this to be a nuke. He's going to have a fission rocket, fission setup to do this. All right, here's the goal. He wants to land three helicopters, similar to Ingenuity, the one that went up years ago and that was very successful. He wants to send three of them to the moon, to Mars. But now, how's he going to get them there? By the way, he wants to send all three at the same time. They call that Starf. I think he's calling it Starf. But he needs a rocket to get there. Pushing a nuclear system. What he wants to do is have this fission rocket produce enough heat to spin up a turbine. Drop it a second. Amazing how high. High the temperature gets on these two meter rigs. Medium power. Well, anyway, he wants to send this. It's called Space Reactor One. Space Reactor One Freedom. And what happened was I talked about doing away with the Gateway Space Station. Gateway Space Station was there. Getting to actually put this thing into orbit. Now, okay, canceled. But now what do you do with the other parts? Well, one of them is the habitat. Now he's got dreams of taking his habitat module instead of throwing it away and putting it down on the moon. By the way, it's kind of ridiculous because it wasn't planned on going to the moon. It's not designed for the stresses that you have sitting on the moon or the moon. Regular the environment and the hatches and the seals that will never work out. Anyway, he has plans on utilizing it, so it's not good. And he's an element power and propulsion element power, meaning, you know, normally you would be getting power solar cells. This thing, instead of getting solar cells, he wants to use a fission engine, a nuclear engine, to power this rocket that's going to be heading to Mars. And so he's taken the power element that was supposed to be part of the space station, the Gateway space station, and that's going to be used now to send it to Mars. The power element consisted of a whole bunch of all ion thrusters, not little ones, you know, good-sized ones, that will be run on electricity being produced by the fission rocket system. Fission rocket is going to create enough heat to take xenon gas and I think helium mixed together, and gas will, once it heats up, will go flying through a turbine. Turbine spins up fast enough to produce 20 kilowatts of power. It's a lot. I mean, I have a generator. It's, what, 4K? It does practically my whole house. This thing's going to be 20K, you know, five times that amount, maybe, to take the electricity and run these ion engines. So he's, by doing this, he's going to get extra speed. Instead of like 6 months to Mars, I guess he's trying to cut that down in half or something. So this will be the America's first nuclear-powered vehicle. So I thought that's interesting. A couple of years away from actual launch, but it's being funded. This thing is going to cost $2 billion to construct. And when it gets there, its mission really, from what I see, is just to release three helicopters and let them fly around on Mars for months on end. We'll see. Any comments, WS to us?
KC2SHO.
How are you? WS2N, back to you, John.
Yeah, as you're describing this nuclear-powered rocket, you know, I'm thinking of some history I read about the attempts to make, like, a nuclear-powered aircraft. And you know, most of it was abandoned. Well, there's probably many reasons it was abandoned, but one of the reasons was it was just too hard to shield the occupants from the reactor. You know, the weight made it, the weight of shielding you would need to protect the pilots and crew was just way too high to actually have a feasible aircraft. Obviously, weight is a concern for getting spacecraft off the ground. There's no occupants, obviously, but we also know that many electronics and these types of things don't deal with that that kind of environment either. So just wondering what your comments were on that. KC2SHO, go ahead.
Yeah, it's sort of preliminary design of this Space Reactor One Freedom thing that they're talking about. It's pretty long, so I'm assuming that they're going to have the fission part of it far enough away from the other electronics, you know, communication electronics, and these little three helicopters that they plan on landing on Mars. Probably at the far end, you know, the last thing they need is radiation spilling over. Affect the electronics. That's why you would have maybe a long truss in between. You know, keep the reactor at one end and the valuable electronics on the other end. So, it's a big difference than these RTGs that, for instance, the rovers have been using, the two rovers, Curiosity and Perseverance. You know, they have 109-watt output of radioisotope thermoelectric generators and they run out, of course, all the time, and they're constantly charging these two 40-amp-hour batteries. So they always have that, it's always recharging. So even if the robot's not doing anything, it's getting power. The RTG and the battery, runs when they need to drive somewhere to do whatever they're doing, drill into rocks or use the chemistry lab. But this thing has got, by the time they're done, this gas is going to be being pushed through a turbine. Turbine's the generator, produces 20 kilowatts of energy. And then the gas goes into area, it's going from a high pressure then down to a lower pressure, and then it's going to go into a heat exchanger, so the gas never leaves the vehicle, so you're never going to run out of gas. But to get rid of the heat, they're going to need, from what I see, a pretty large radiator. The convection radiators really don't work in space, so you need these similar radiator what you have on the space station. You're just going to get rid of heat that way. You're not going to have regular, there's no air going by, so you're just going to have to.
That time,
have
complete.
A different kind of system that they're going to have quite large. So I don't know if this thing's ever going to get built, but I mean, they say that it's starting to be funding by NASA. I mean, they are coming up with one thing after the other lately. It was kind of unnerving anyway. Cancel this, do this, let's try that. It's a lot different than what I remember from the old-time space programs. Back to you, John. WSY.
Yeah, real good. Yeah, I guess that's kind of what I was picturing when you were talking about it. Some distance would help, yeah, it still sounds lofty, nonetheless. No pun intended. But real good. Okay. Yeah, I don't know if I have any more comments on it, but I do appreciate hearing all about that. And not keeping up much on the space news and recent times. Life's been pretty busy, so I do appreciate the SpaceNet report. I'll leave it back to you for whatever else you want to add on or put a bow on it. WS Plan from KC2SHF. Thanks.
KC2SHO, WS Plan, and thanks for coming in there, John. Yeah, well, it's getting late. I did want to mention that they have another 3D printer on the International Space Station. They've had one before, but that's pretty much works on plastic or almost like a hot ceramic printer. But they actually have a metal one up there on the Columbus module, and one of the newer astronauts up there, actually she's from France, Sophie, she's working on this thing, and they said so far it's very successful, a new printer, but they need to be able to make real solid, important pieces. If you're on a long mission to Mars, you need a part. You're 6 months to a year away from getting it from Earth. So, you'd be able to, put the program into the 3D printer, and, next thing you have a gear or a nozzle or something, whatever you need for whatever's broken. So I think it's pretty interesting. I'm fascinated with these 3D printers. Anyway, we're up to wishing hour. I see it's 11 o'clock, so I guess we'll turn it back over to Roy. Thank everybody that participated, and everybody that stood by and listened to me. And tomorrow is the Limark Club InfoNet, and that'll be 8:30 on these repeaters, followed by Swap It by Radio Newsline. I believe this week is the picnic, the Limark picnic. That would be at Bethpage. You can find all that information on the Limark website. But now, let me turn it over to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N, for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for all that you do for the Space Net Report, for the TechNet, and all you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had fun. I hope you enjoyed yourself. And I hope if you're able, you'll come back next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. As is our usual practice, before I leave, let me remind you of a couple of comments from some clever people. One, our own Dick, H-R-I-W, he would end his technical nets with the good advice to be kind to each other. I always like to quote good old Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. Keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brains fall out, because you're going to need it one of these days. Anyway, have a great week. Stay safe. Be well. And if you possibly can, come back next Sunday when we're going to try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say Slava Ukraini.
AC2GSKC2SHO.
Hello, John. How you doing tonight? You hear me, John?
Hi, there you are. Yeah, Roy. I heard you talking about your website earlier, and didn't catch every detail, but it sounds like you just need to get a certificate. That's nothing new for HTTPS. Don't know what your hosting solution is, but like my hosting solution gives me one free certificate with the package. So don't know if that's helpful or not, or if I'm on the right track. EC2GS from KC2SHL.
Yeah, you are. I need an SSL certificate. But the problem is that I don't actually own the website. I'm just kind of piggybacking off of other people.
Oh, okay. Gotcha, understood. So, not sure how that plays out. But generally, subdomains, they work under the same certificate, I thought. But you have your own now. You have EC2GS, so you own that. You may be able to put multiple certificates on per se. Yeah, I'm not the expert on it, but anyway. real good. I guess that's all I have.
Okay, I mean, thanks for the suggestion. No, the problem is that it doesn't have a website. It only has a domain, and I just point the domain elsewhere. To a place that doesn't have an SSL certificate.
Okay, so you're redirecting? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I gotcha. Yeah, what are you going to do if you want to host it yourself? You got to pay someone for that, and that's another whole game. I still pay for that myself just because, I don't know. I guess I'm old school and I don't know how else to do it. And I want to have control and I want to have my own email and things that aren't tied to Google or Yahoo or any of those players. So that is one nice thing. All right, I got to give on to some stuff here, but thanks for the net this evening and... I look forward to the next time.
You're welcome. Thanks for participating. Yeah, I have mail servers. I pay for things that I need for myself, but for other people,